excited and, in fact, honored to have your company this afternoon as I chat to Njabulo Ndebele, who I think all of us will agree has brought to our writing a sensitivity that is quite unusual, and the incisiveness of his views, of his descriptions of things are just absolutely awesome. And he has written many books, including The Cry of Winnie Mandela, and Fools and Other Stories. And we're going to be chatting today about his newest book. And I think for those of you who've seen Fine Lines from the Box, you will see that it obviously covers quite a wide span. And in my discussion with Njabulo, we're basically just going to tackle some of the issues that are in the book. And I think in his usual style, he both teases, provokes, and just gets you a sense of what are some of the nuances, where many social commentators use social commentary as a very blunt instrument. He seems to use social commentary as almost like a brush, you know, so in the palette there are so many of the colors. It's really an honor for me to present the work of Njabulo Ndebele.
Thank you.
And I know the temptation will have been there to do the usual introduction and tell you what he's done. And I think that in these days, you know, suffice it to say that he's a man who's worthy of talking to. He's just finished his tenure as principal and vice chancellor of the University of Cape Town, and is going to be traveling to upstate New York to take a sabbatical at Bard College. And his work and achievements are just too numerous to mention. So I'll just delve straight into the questions that I've prepared for the book Fine Lines from the Box. Njabulo, in your book Fine Lines from the Box, one of the most unforgettable moments is when you unearthed what you suggest was really a treasure that lay hidden in the box. I mean, how much do you see writing as something you both treasure, and that is in fact part of our larger social treasure?
Well, thank you very much, Victor. I have been myself hoping that I will have an opportunity to chat with you for some time. So it's the meeting is mutual today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Yes. Thank you.
I think that the best way to respond to your question is to observe that I have grown up in an environment of books and reading and writing. It's something that I like to talk about, or at least to mention upfront, because sometimes I think that there is a stereotype about growing up in a township, which is always around poverty and deprivation and so on. This is not to suggest that these things are not there. They are there and they are all over. But it also is to make the point that there are many other people in those environments who are doing everything they can to rise above and out of the trap. So there are, even in the most unexpected places in the township, you might find a piano, you might find a guitar, a musical instrument, you might find books, you might find a whole lot of things that if you do not live there, you don't associate with that kind of environment. So I actually do like to say that there were books in my house. There was reading, there was a radio. I listened to classical music that my father played, and jazz and so on. And so that is because that environment then nurtures the imagination of young people that are in it, and so you learn to treasure the world, the life of the imagination, and you when you mention then that the book spans almost two or three decades of South African contemporary history, it's a history also of my literary response to those events in our history over a period of time. And what writing forces you to do is once you put down a word, you go back to think about it, its appropriateness, whether it is sufficiently accurate or whether it is sufficiently nuanced, does it convey what you really want to do. So writing is an act of contemplation. Not only do you express something, but you also express yourself, because writing enhances self-knowledge and self-awareness.
I think talking about that, I mean, as you quite rightly say, it's about expression, but I also got a sense reading through your work that even though expression is often highly regarded, not just because it renders the private public, but because when it is well done, it can lift the fog of ignorance with devastating effectiveness. I mean, what of reflection? Because it remains private, but surely it must fuel the most meaningful expression, or to use your expression, meaningful engagement. And I got a sense that even though those are your expressions, there was a larger body of reflection, perhaps some of which may not yet have hit the page, because so much of it seems to be you looking at South Africa in its various engagement with itself, whether it's the universities, whether it's game lodges, and on some things after reflection, you then express your views or even engage the views of others.
Yes. Well, I think I like to call the genre that I use is a genre of the speculative essay, and in which I don't have to do the kind of research that you have to do if you are to write a book of history or politics or whatever, but that the absence of that historical or social data then makes more possible the depth of contemplation, using your experience as well as your engagement with the outside world to fashion something. This morning I happened to facilitate a panel discussion in which Meg Maharaj, press governor, Makosa Zahana Klaba, and Mark Gavisa were talking about their biographies or autobiographies, and what came through in that discussion, which was shared by everyone, was the fact that a biography is about an individual and those around them, but to the extent that when someone writes about himself or someone else writes about someone in a concentrated way, that biography does, to the extent that the readers of the biography see certain aspects of themselves in the biography, that they recognize certain reference points in the environment around them, makes them participate, the more imagined that experience is recreated, the more agent and the more people participate, so that with more and more people reading autobiography or biography, that you get the sense of at some point a critical mass of South Africans talking to themselves in a very deep conversation. And if the autobiography or the biography is sincere, it is sincere only when the writer is unflinching about those aspects of themselves that show them in the light of being vulnerable, of being insecure, and how therefore they overcome those insecurities. We are used to, in our South African history, to the history of heroes and leaders who are larger than life. And I have found that with myself, I go only up to a certain point with heroes who are larger than life. At some point, I don't know them. The best moment that I had into Lenin, for example, this person who is larger than life, who led the Russian Revolution, that changed the face of world history. The best moment I saw him and I really identified with him was when he was lying down in some hall with Gorky, the novelist, expressing his fears about whether it's all going to work. And he was feeling, I don't think it's going to work. You know, it's that moment of vulnerability that suddenly makes you see something, because the fact that he at that moment he shows fears, insecurities, makes you identify with him in a way that you yourself feel it is possible to overcome the fears and the difficulties, but only if you are able to accept that you have them. And so we are going through a critical historical moment in our country. We have absorbed so much that has become obvious, and most of us want to demonstrate our knowledge of the obvious, that we keep repeating it, that when someone shows something else that is different, we are a bit insecure. So I think that writing is about opening up what seldom gets talked about, and put it out there into the public domain, so that you can expand the boundaries of communication.
What you're touching on fascinates me, because I think in many ways you're talking about the leaders who have been tempted to portray themselves as larger than life, but somewhere in your book you also, I think, take issue with the nation as such. You write in the book, "I have known all along that as we move further away from 27 April 1994, we will become increasingly normal and more ordinary, shedding the well-deserved sense of specialness." And I wanted to ask you, I mean, looking back on the last 14 years, how much of a trap, perhaps even a curse, was it for South Africans to appropriate for themselves the tag of a special nation?
Yeah, it's been very, it's a very difficult thing we've taken on to ourselves. And, you know, and the vulnerability that it exposes us to. One of the things I often reflect on is that I think I'd like to commend the current government, particularly under the leadership of the Minister of Finance. We have an economy that is relatively free, I mean, independent. I mean, we are not we're not under the control of the World Bank. You know, there are countries that because they have these huge loans, you know, from the World Bank, and they're having difficulty paying them back. And the World Bank has to say, okay, if you're having difficulties paying back, you are going to have to do 1, 2, 3, 4 in order to be able to pay me back. And it has gone under various names, including structural adjustment and so on, which in most cases, countries simply became poorer and poorer and more dependent. We are not in that. But I think our vulnerability is that we are not able to protect that economic independence with strong social underpinnings. Our community life is very fragile, and you can tell now that we have done much to make sure that our economic system, our structures, our constitutional at the macro level are all in place and seem to be working well, but there are some difficulties now with the judiciary, you know, and so on and so forth. But generally, but what we don't have is our vulnerability is at the local level. So that is where we are now going to have to focus our attention, and it is there that you have to confront the ordinariness that in order for us to become a successful nation, we've got to have to do more than simply show that we have a good economy. It's got to be sustainable, and the only way it can be sustainable is if the social base is strong. So we can't avoid, therefore, having to focus on our townships. What is happening in Soweto is just in the right direction, because now Soweto, what they are trying to do with, they're trying to create a huge local economy that's grounded in the realities of the society there. And so in order for us to avoid that vulnerability that I'm talking about, we are going to have to be grounded in our own realities. And the question that I want to leave for South Africans is to answer is, who are we living for? We are not living to prove to the world that we can be like it. I think that's part of it. Part of it is that the most fundamental challenge is that we have to now live for ourselves. And in living for ourselves, we live for the outside world as well. We've got to love who we are, and that will take care of all the violence that is there's so much of it in our communities. When someone is given a contract to build homes somewhere in the township for people who have been wanting these homes, and it all turns out that what they've been doing is to put together sand and water, and because the buildings start collapsing after six weeks for poor people, we've got to be very hard on because it is a profound disrespect for people to use public monies to build homes that are going to collapse for people who have been hoping, you know, to have a home, you know, for over a long period of time. That is what. So our laws, therefore, must be very harsh on people who do this. At the moment, we seem to be focusing on the people, sort of the high level crime, the corruption at the top. We need to be much more intolerant of crimes directed at poor people at the bottom.
One of the things that you do in your book, you talk about how there has always been a reaction of naming and shaming and focusing on corruption, and you instead ask South Africans to imagine what it will be like to focus on the corruptive environment. Yeah. On how is it that what are the things that lead to a corruptive environment, and in a society which likes to apportion blame, why are you moving away from the focus on the individual to a much more structural view of what is really seen as a moral and a social cancer? Because I suppose for many people who are shocked by corruption, it's easier to understand it at a personal level, that what motivates someone to literally steal from government and from society. And why did you feel compelled to really go against the grain. And I think in your book, there's a great deal of what you call counter-intuition, whether it's through Moshoeshoe or through Mandela, this idea that often when we think we know what's the right thing to do, it yields predictable results. But when we engage in what you call counter-intuition, the results are far more profound.
Well, I have one recent example to illustrate that, which is this matter that you all heard about, the instances of incidents of what of racism at the University of the Free State, where three or so one white Afrikaner young males subjected four black women to some really horrendous, you know, humiliation. I was fascinated by how South Africans responded to that. We have no less than two commissions to look into racism in higher education institutions. Now, I think that is fine. But for me, the more fundamental question is not so much that we have discovered yet another instance of racism. Of course, what do you expect? Of course, you'll find. So chances are that the commission will in fact confirm what we already know. The more fundamental question for me is not so much that we've seen one more instance of racism. It is the fact that these three young men were probably 3 or 4 years old when Mandela was released or whatever. It can be racism as such. More fundamentally, what the incident says to me is it puts the light on how each and every one of us South Africans, all of us in here, how in fact do we socialize in the next generation? That is the question. So as soon as you ask the question, how do you socialize the next generation, then it ceases to be just the so-called racism of the three kids. It is a question that is thrown right back at our schools, at our families, at the nature of our communities. What I talked about earlier on about focusing now on the communities, the schools, the churches, the institutions of governance at the local level, and so on. That is where the socialization takes place. So when I say that, let's not look at the obvious. Sometimes the more attention you give to the obvious, it has the effect of trivializing your own perceptions, because you don't move beyond them. But if you twist things a little bit and try to look at the underlying reality, you are likely to find solutions that are far more sustainable and therefore lead to a much more profound redefinition or discovery of the South African identity, which will have further down the line. So that's what I hope that's a useful illustration of what I was trying to address in what you were referring to.
Can I ask you, I suppose, a question that someone with your breadth of vision and incisiveness of thought will probably give us some sense of it. When the Rainbow Nation first appeared, I mean, it seemed to capture for so many of us with an economy of symbolism and language, the hopes of South Africans. But looking at your piece, The Liberation and the Crisis of Culture, in which you write, and I'll quote a little bit from it, the challenge of culture in South Africa is one that results from the interaction of many languages yielding discordant meanings. In this situation, we need to look for a creative point of convergence, such as would inspire a universal confidence that our strivings towards a viable national culture are based on as inclusive an understanding as possible. Now, given the fissures, the fractures, the noises over the past 2 years, certainly, do you still think the pursuit of a national culture is something that could be meaningfully imagined?
Yeah, I think so. I think that as long as you understand that the outcome is not necessarily going to be something that is easily definable. In the same way that you know, I believe you can see there is no definitive definition of an Englishman or a French or whatever. Even it's a very elusive. Now you have it, now you don't. And I think it's bound to be the same with us. So if we are not looking for something that is encapsulating, we are not likely to find it. But if we in our search for it, we accept that we might be confused along the way. That is it, you know, because it is actually working your way through confusion that knowledge emerges.
Can I interrupt you there? Because part of what you do, you talk about, you gave us the example of a biography, that at its most meaningful, it's when the writer submit to weakness, to doubt, to uncertainty, and not be gung-ho all the time. And you seem to be asking South Africans as well, in one of your most powerful essays that I read and had to reread, where you talk about how President Mbeki's contrarian views on the AIDS orthodoxy have been read in a way that is not just unkind, but it probably undermines the idea of people holding views that are contrary to not just the popular ones, but the ones that participate in orthodoxy. And in talking about South African culture, I suppose what you're really saying also is that whereas people may like to hold on to the idea of a very firm, solid idea of what a nation means, perhaps when sometimes they are sure and sometimes they're not sure, it's okay.
Yeah. Well, that was a very difficult essay for me to write. This is the one on Nigeria. What I was really trying to do there is quite consistent with what I'm trying to understand, which is that at a certain point it was very easy to pigeonhole President Mbeki and define him as a denialist. And when you go to the origins of this, you can actually trace, which is what I tried to do, a lot of extensive research on the issue, exactly where it starts. Paradoxically, I remember when I was President Mbeki was elected, I was in New York at the time, but I just finished my tour of duty at the University of the North in 1998. I went to live in the United States. And when President Mbeki was elected, Minister Fahad, in his office, Aziz is the older one, isn't it? Isop, that's right. He was asked, so who is Mbeki? Are we going to talk about, we want to interview him. Who is he? What? Tell us about him. And his response was, you know, we South Africans, you know, in his inimitable way, who are you, you know? We South Africans are not like you Americans. A president's life, private life, is a president's life. Why should you bother, you know, about it? Which I agreed with to some extent. I liked his sort of telling them, you know, to go off, you know, because Americans need to be reminded, you know, from time to time. So I like that. But on the other hand, I said, oh, there's a grave danger here, because if the someone does not market or manage the image of President Mbeki, someone else is going to do it, and and indeed someone else knew. And so once it started in the New York, in the Washington Post, that particular essay, it took a life of its own. And you can actually trace so what I was fascinated about in reflecting on Begin and AIDS was not so much to defend or not to defend him, but to pay attention to how an idea can take a life of its own and all of us become subject to it. Whenever that happens and I feel that I'm being sucked into it, I have an instinctive reaction to go the other way. And so I needed to, I'm going to try and understand what is it that God pressed at the baby into this situation. And when I did, I found that it was a complex thing. I found that even as he was trying to understand AIDS in its complexity, bringing together in a most scientific way people who hold different positions on it, so that he could be better informed, I believed, how he could deal with this in a comprehensive way. He'd already lost the battle, and he's never regained it. So the point I was saying was the vulnerability of human beings to positions that can be thrown out there, and then they can be absorbed uncritically, and then they take a life of its own. And once that happens, it will take many, many years, you know, to undo it. So we are all vulnerable to that sort of thing. And so that particular piece, therefore, was not to defend or condemn, but just to understand that feature. And there's a lot of things that in our society that are precisely like that, that then we get socialized into accepting something even when it is wrong. Many of us very soon are going to be, will forget that there was ever Travelgate, you know, because we just move on, and that the stasis around Travelgate assumes a normality that then dissipates, and someone's gotten scot-free. And so there are many things like that in our society today that require what I call the South African citizen to take their life and be more reflective and be more interested in how your opinions are influenced or shaped, and that it's crucial that you've got to exercise more personal responsibility for what you believe in. So the multiplicity of independent, autonomous South Africans who are able to make up their own minds makes leadership more difficult. But then leadership is about facilitating and working with the difficulty rather than pretending that it is not there.
Well, one of the things that you actually, in your essay that I consider most charged with the imagination, which is the essay, The Year of the Dog, there is a piece of speculation that yields a moment of both linguistic and philosophical delight. And you write of Zizi that I like to think he yielded to the seductiveness of a thoughtless moment. And what I wanted to find out from you, isn't this seductiveness of thoughtless moments what makes populism so dangerous?
Absolutely. as essay was particularly about that, because somebody thought that they felt they had the power and the justification to say, because I had expressed an opinion, that I am a dog that has to be beaten, you know, and supposed to death. And so I play with the image, and so I take this image of a dog being bitten and push it to its logical conclusions in order to indicate precisely the ugliness that is hidden at the point that they say, beat the dogs. You don't see the ugliness. You see the excitement and the thoughtlessness of the moment, which somehow makes this person feel that they have all the power in the world. And the essay then explores precisely that what in fact can happen when you give away to someone else the power to define your perceptions. And the essay then tries to push this to its logical conclusions.
Well, one of the things that you did in your book was to revisit some of the anthropologies that have come to define us, even though so many of them are invisible to us. The question you ask in the piece, game lodges and leisure colonialists, which is both funny and personal, is this question is a very important one, I think, for all of us. You ask the question, how is it that a simple quest for peace and restoration turned into an unexpectedly painful journey into the self? You then retreat into the third person. We think there is no peace for those caught in the process of becoming. And the question that I wanted to ask you is, how much is the culture of game lodges a symptom of a larger cultural divide that is overlooked in the rush to finesse old anthropologies into new commerce?
Okay. Well, those of you who may not have read the article, it's one of my favorites, actually. It's about an experience I had when I visited the game lodge. And suddenly when I was there, I struck up a friendship with an American family that was visiting. And it became quite a good relationship. I mean, we've stayed in touch, you know, since that time. And it was interesting because a game lodge, it suddenly struck me, is like being, for a black person going there, you suddenly find that everything in there is about sort of the old Africa. So that even yourself as a black person who is visiting, you sort of suddenly feel yourself under the scrutiny of the same circumstances in which you voluntarily brought yourself there to come and enjoy, but you become the object of the tourists themselves. And then an intriguing thing happens, because you then get locked into this thing where the relationship that you have between yourself and the black workers becomes quite problematic. Because at one level, you realize that both of you are in this situation. So there is a solidarity there. But on the other level, you realize that that solidarity is also perilous, because the more the solidarity plays itself out, the more you lose out on the quality of the service. Because the sooner when this person thinks you are just friends, they start not giving you the service, you know, that you have paid for. And it can be quite a perilous situation. But the worst part of it is that as the days go by, and you keep doing the game lodge, you're visiting the lodges, the animals, and so on. Sometimes you really feel like you sympathy for the animals that are being viewed, because you have a sense that you probably should be there, you know, being viewed with the animals, you know, and so it's quite an existential quandary that led to the exploration of the thing that the more perhaps devastating part of the experience, if you extend it to the national scene, is that black people have to be careful that your experience of the whole of South Africa is that you are in a game lodge, that you are in fact being observed, and that there are moments when you feel that in relation to other Africans in other parts of the world, you think, ah, I'm better off. But in fact, you are not in a very fundamental way, because you've got to negotiate the position from which you experience either freedom or are you in charge or are you just being viewed? And that is a tremendous existential question for South Africa, which takes me back to the question point I asked earlier: who are South Africans living for? And in fact, I will then even more narrow the definition further. Who do black South Africans live for?
Well, I suppose on that point, one of the things that you do in the book, I mean, it's clearly very sensitive to the shifts in language and cultural register. But some of the pieces that you write explore both silence, absence, and even invisibility. Now, there's a quote which you repeat from J.M. Coetzee, who in White Writing says, if the work of hands on a particular patch of earth, digging, plowing, planting, building, is what inscribed it as the property of its occupiers by right, then the hands of black serfs doing the work had better not be seen. And this is a powerful quotation, and I suppose there is often in South Africa a philosophical battle about who actually civilized and built South Africa. And in the larger context of your work, what is your sense of the philosophical position that divides people on who brought civilization and who built this country? Or is it really these questions fueled more by the idea of some work and some contribution being invisible and some voices being silent?
It's a fundamental question to ask when I go back again, who do black South Africans live for? And it has to do with why, let me give you one example. You recall that there was some debate in the newspapers in the public domain not too long ago about black journalists wanting to have a meeting with Zuma and only for black journalists and so on. And I asked myself, why do black, is there a group of people, black people in South Africa in 2008 who resort to strategies that predate 1994? Why do they feel so unfree that they have to bring attention to their color in 2008, when by which I would have hoped in 2008 there would be so much self-accepting that they don't have to define themselves as black, because the whole country is black with the black government and so on and so forth, that I've asked myself that particular question. And I think it has to do with the fact that it's about institutions of culture. The institutions of culture created by white South Africans, the mines, parliament, government institutions, universities, film cinemas, theaters, factories, and so on and so forth. We black people in South Africa are always having to adjust to these cultured environments in the boardroom, everywhere you have to learn what has been put together over a period of time. And whenever you get there, you find there are those that are so good at this because they've been in it for decades, in some cases centuries. And those Black South Africans, women, sometimes are just coming in and having to adjust to a mode of doing things that is set and embedded. And that is what I think people sometimes mean by how do we transform the environment. The fact is, therefore, that the bulk of Black people are then having to adjust to these things. The reason is very simple. Cultural institutions, Black South African cultural institutions, were systematically destroyed over a long period of time. And I can only make reference to one devastating manifestation of it, when Black men were asked to leave their homes to go and, in order to be able to pay tax, to go and give themselves over as labor, you know, in the factories. That happening over two or three centuries devastated the social fabric of African life. So, one of the things then that post-Polokwane promises when people were writing it was that the opportunity, therefore, to rebuild our communities that I referred to earlier is an opportunity to set up new cultural institutions that people in the communities are familiar with. One example, I was and many others are educated out of their communities. If I want to be a lawyer, I can't be a lawyer in Duduza, my township, because the infrastructure does not support that. If you have to be a lawyer, I must go to the city center outside, or go to Johannesburg or Durban or Cape Town or wherever, and make a living. If you want to be an architect, you can't be an architect in Duduza. You have to go out and make. On the other hand, if I live in Rondebosch and I want to be a lawyer, I want to be an architect, the environment supports my desires because everything around makes it possible for me to participate. So the point I'm trying to make is that the average township is a desert of cultural institutions as we understand them. So it does not sustain cultural life and cultural experience. And that unless we get that right, we are going to have generations of South Africans who grew up, are born in a particular environment, grow up in it, leave it in order to create a life outside, away from where they have grown. And that existential instability is probably also at the heart of the South African problem, cultural problem today. So the big challenge, therefore, is mentioned in one of the essays, is if in Duduza you have a taxi service that was created by the people of Duduza to take people from one part of the township to another, as opposed to taking people from the township to the city, you have the opportunity to create a local economy where, with a spare part industry, fuel, you know, petrol, and whatever, taking place right there, including training institutions that train technical people for mechanics and so on around there. And so what we need, therefore, is a facilitative government policy that sees community initiatives and supports them, together with many NGOs that have a history of community involvement, which in the last 14 years, many of them have been marginalized, and all the good work that they have been done, they have done of, is not given sufficient support and recognition. So the issue of culture and institutions is at the heart of this question. But it doesn't mean that you have got to start from scratch and ignore the other. It simply means that all of us have, as South Africans, can go back to the issue of the Free State that I used. How do all of us socialize the next generation? It has to do with creating new cultural realities, changing old ones, making them something different that is accommodative, and along the way, we will become a character will emerge that can define us as South Africans.
Have you been surprised by how much your book has struck a chord with South Africans? Because I was talking to Anna Marie, your publisher, and she was telling me that it has to go into a reprint. Because one ordinarily imagines that essays that are highly speculative, philosophical, often dealing with issues in ways that seem roundabout. Have you been surprised that people have just bought it out of the bookshops?
I have been surprised. But on the other hand, I'm thinking that South Africans are looking for new perspectives. And they are looking for different ways of approaching a familiar reality, and it might be that the essays provide that newness of perspective. I've been surprised but not unhappy.
Well, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that the format that we've taken has been one that has yielded some insights. I hope I've been able to tease some of the answers from what is undoubtedly a very fine mind, and certainly one of the joys that I've had with Njabulo's work is one of the joys that I think we underestimate in the world of books, the joy of rereading. Each time I encounter, whether it's The Cry of Winnie Mandela or any of his other books, I'm often shocked by how a second reading yields to me meanings that may have been hidden by the first one. And so I urge you, even if you think you've read the works, to go back and read them. It's been such an honor to chat to Njabulo, and I think as he goes on his sabbatical, we hope that he takes with him his pen and he continues to write for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.